So we're in session two at the moment. As I said earlier, we've got three talks coming up on broadly around the subject of privacy and data. Three relatively short talks, about 10 minutes, I think, or save questions at the end, you know, if that's okay. So if you want to kind of make a mention of those any questions you've got, and we'll put them to the panel at the end. Okay, so Helen.
Great. Hi, thanks. I'm Caroline Sincalo. I'm with Privacy International, and I'm here today to give you a little bit of a preview of what we think is coming out in the next year of what we're calling Snowgenie.
Much less apparent type of surveillance you're carrying out. So these are sort of
fundamentally why I think our laws and policies are not up to shape to deal with this kinds of technological change that's facilitating type surveillance Snowden has shown us is happening right now, because they are just designed for a period of time when these capabilities didn't exist. So what else has Snowden showed us? We talked about mass surveillance. But it's interesting that up until this point, in the surveillance context, we already saw what the spies really want and what law enforcement really want is content. They want to know what you're writing in your email, what you're writing in your letter. That's the most interesting thing. And so a lot of our laws are designed to protect content much more than anything else. But it turns out they actually really like metadata. What they want to see is who you're communicating with, who you know, when you are different places, because there's a big argument about whether metadata can include your location. Certainly it can, but whether or not from a legal perspective it includes your location information as well. That's much more useful to them. And actually just this last week a report came out from an independent advisor to Parliament here about all of the intelligence services and the law enforcement's powers in the UK. And Ian Zemek is going to talk about this a little bit more. But he talked to law enforcement and the intelligence services, and they said, you know what, actually what we value most is the metadata. We could take or leave content. I mean, that's not entirely true. They still find content pretty interesting, but it's not quite as interesting then as it used to be. And in part, that is because, I've got my slides in the wrong order here. Well, in part, that is because of encryption. So the better we are getting, and especially we've gotten a lot better actually in the last 2 years post Snowden's revelations, the better we are getting at encrypting our communications, the less likely the spies are to actually be able to see what that content is. But of course, they're still getting to see the metadata. So they're pulling much more information from that metadata. And also, as I think was famously said in the US, they really like the haystack. They want to build the haystack so they can find the needle. And it's really much easier to build the haystack with the metadata and form the connections they want than it is with the content. So what's the third interesting thing that we've seen come out of Snowden, and it's a fight that's going to be going forward? And I think that is government hacking. So more and more we're seeing intelligence services, in part due to the rise of encryption, in part due to the fact that they've just gotten much better at it, engage in hacking, or what they call computer network exploitation, or also what they sometimes call equipment interference. So this is something that wasn't even admitted to, in many cases prior to this year. The UK first admitted, their intelligence service first admitted they engaged in hacking in February of this year. But it turns out that they're doing it on a larger scale. This example here, this is one of the Snowden documents, this is a slide talking about a hack into Belgacom, a major Belgian telecommunications company. And the reason they were hacking them, they don't think of them as a national security target. They think of them as an end to a means. If they can get to them, then they can, means to an end. Thank God. means to an end. If they can get to them, then they can get to everyone else who might be using them as a communication system. So that raises a whole new question too, which is if we're going to say that hacking is even an acceptable method for the government to be using in order to gather intelligence, and that's questionable, is it particularly acceptable if they're going after what we call completely suspicious, innocent companies or people? And here they were hacking systems in order to get this access. Is that acceptable as well? So these are all the fights that we're going to be having over the next couple of years. So we eventually come to the point where, while we're still learning some interesting things from the Snowden documents, we're starting to be able to take action on them. And I think that's the really interesting thing that's going to happen over the next couple of years, is that we're going to start to have these debates about law and policy and changing technology, and see where we might be able to actually rein in the intelligence services and law enforcement's capabilities in this regard, if we think that's the right thing to do. So where do we go from here? Well, in the UK, we're about to face a complete overhaul of the surveillance powers of both intelligence services and law enforcement, and that's something Ian's going to talk about very shortly. In the US, we actually just saw the passage of the USA Freedom Act, which didn't go nearly far enough for what a lot of people wanted, but what it did is it somewhat reined in the NSA's capability to collect metadata on US persons, so people either within the US territory or outside of the US who are US citizens. And it's one of the reasons it's important is it was one of the first times since September 11th that actually the NSA's powers were circumscribed and weren't expanded upon. So it's an interesting and great opportunity to continue for us to try to reduce the ability of governments to intrude upon our privacy through these really invasive surveillance techniques. And finally, other countries, we're actually finding new surveillance laws are coming out all over the place right now. In the Netherlands, in France, in Germany, just different data protection and surveillance considerations in Brazil. So all over the world, people are having this discussion right now, in large part due to Snowden's revelations, and it's just a pretty exciting time to see where we can go from here.
I'll try to get a lot of detail into these slides. I won't have time to go right through them, but I just tweeted them. So if you want to actually follow along the slides, you can see them on Twitter. As Caroline said, there has of course been a lot of criticism of the UK legal framework for interception for many years from civil society groups like Privacy International, but that has become even more mainstream in the last couple of years, largely thanks to all of the discussion generated by the Snowden revelations. So you can see from different people there, David Anderson, the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, who published a very detailed report on the UK legal framework just last week. You can see there him saying that it's currently incomprehensible to all but a tiny band of initiates. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. I don't know how many of you have tried to read through the Regulation of Investigative Powers Act, which is the main piece of legislation, but as I'll come back to in a moment, all sorts of other powers in other acts, which often are very opaque, very difficult to understand, deliberately so often, because what they're trying to do is put a legal framework in place for agencies, particularly GCHQ, to do often large-scale interceptions, as I mentioned, but without giving away too much about the actual sources and methods that they use to do that, because of concerns in the intelligence community. If people know what they're doing, then of course they might change the ways that they're actually communicating to try to frustrate some of those. So you can see also from the Intelligence and Security Committee report that was published earlier this year. That's a parliamentary committee that did an 18-month investigation into the UK legal framework and Snowden revelations. You can see they say it's absurdly complicated. And then lastly, Anthony May, who is the Interception of Communications Commissioner, he's a retired Court of Appeal judge, that has this post to oversee the way that all of these powers are used and make sure that they're not being abused. You can see he was appointed at the start of 2013, and he said in his first annual report, it took me as a Court of Appeal judge a year to understand in working. I don't think he works completely full-time, but certainly 50% of his time. So very difficult, even for someone you would think should not find it so. You can't quite see all the text here, but what I've tried to do is to take some of the recommendations, the key recommendations from that Intelligence and Security Committee report and from the Anderson report that was just published last week, and show you where there are many points of similarities in what those two different reports recommend. And so we can see where there is commonality. It's much more likely, of course, that the government will take up those recommendations. And as Caroline says, we're looking at a complete overhaul of the framework, not just tweaks. So that's what the first row says. So you can't see, importantly, the headline, which is the ISC report is on the left, recommendations, and the Anderson report is on the right. So both of the reports agree the current framework is a mess, there needs to be a complete overhaul, bringing together all of these different powers from different laws in one clearly understandable legal framework. So Anderson in particular says, should be structured and expressed so as to enable its essentials to be understood by intelligent readers across the world, covering not just RIPA, but all these other acts, the Telecommunication powers that are, the legal powers that are used to justify the hacking that Caroline talked about, the large scale hacking, the Wireless Telegraphy Act, which allows the intelligence agencies to interfere with mobile communications. So I suspect that's what they're using to authorize IMSI captures, for example. If you know what those devices are, fake cell towers that will sit between suspects' mobile phones and the actual phone network and intercept information that's going between the two. Secondly, one area where the reports strongly disagree is on whether, as the Intelligence and Security Committee thinks on the left, ministers should continue to authorise interception. So at the moment, it's one of the secretaries of state, usually the Home Secretary when it comes to domestic communications, and the Foreign Secretary when it comes to interception of overseas communications going from the UK to somewhere else in the world or vice versa, including the bulk interception programmes that Caroline mentioned, Tempora and others, that signs those off. The ISC says, well, those ministers are the only people that really appreciate the political context that justifies these interceptions and access to communications data and so on. So it should be ministers that sign off. David Anderson says, no, actually, it would reassure the public, and also it would reassure the technology industry overseas. Most other countries have judges signing off interception warrants. And one of the reasons that there has been some pushback from particularly the big American internet companies that, of course, are holding a lot of the communications that are of interest to our intelligence agencies, they said, look, in the States, you would need a judge-issued warrant to get access to the content of communications. Why is the UK so unusual in insisting that politicians actually sign these things off? So that will be an ongoing argument, I think. Both reports in the third column recognise the sensitivity of communications data, as Caroline said. The current legal framework draws this big divide between the content of a telephone call or an email and so on, and data about it, the who, what, where, as it's sometimes put, information about who people have been talking to, which cell their mobile phone is when calls were made, that kind of data. You can see the ISC acknowledges actually some of that comms data actually is very sensitive in itself. You can't just say it's just like a telephone directory, which has been some of the arguments in the past from the government to say, well, telephone directories aren't that sensitive, telephone bills aren't that sensitive, so we don't need special protection for that kind of data in the way that we have for the content. The ISC and David Anderson both recognise no, especially if you're carrying around a smartphone that's sending quite precise location information over the internet quite frequently. That certainly says a lot about your day-to-day movements, also, of course, who you're spending time with in physical space. So both recognising there should be more protection for that communications data. And then lastly, talking about safeguards, in particular, both of these reports want to maintain these bulk communication programs that Caroline talked about. So I know that is very much not the view of human rights campaigners. They think those bulk interception programs are just de facto too intrusive on people's freedom, people's privacy and other human rights. But both these reports say, no, that capability is very valuable to the agencies in stopping very serious crime. David Anderson gives some examples in one of the annexes to his report of where terrorist groups were detected and arrested based on that bulk data interception and analysis. But what both reports say is there needs to be strong safeguards to make sure that it's not abused. Anderson again talking about replacing the current system of commissioners. So Anthony May is one, there are two others, an intelligence services commissioner and the Chief Surveillance Commissioner and his staff, replacing those with a commission, so a larger body that would include judges that could authorise interception and also access to sensitive communications data, but also take on other roles to do with overseeing the use of these powers, publishing statistics, talking to the media, talking to the public, explaining what the powers are being used for, because I think that has been a problem in the past as well. There's not been much communication. The agencies, of course, rarely communicate with the public, but even the oversight bodies that are supposed to be checking the powers are not being abused in the past, I think, have not done such a good job in talking to the public. The current And then, I'm not going to go right through these, but just some key points from also from Anderson's report that are not mentioned in the ISC report. So I think these will be more of the debate. But briefly, he says, first of all, keep data retention. So I think that's something that privacy groups would be disappointed by. He does acknowledge that there have been, there was a Court of Justice at the EU decision last year, and you're probably familiar with, saying that the EU's data retention directive was such an intrusion on rights it should be completely struck down. So David Anderson does recognise that there is this very strong ruling from the Court of Justice, which will constrain the UK government's laws in future in terms of data retention. But in general, he still thinks that the principle is a good one. Of course, the government does, so no doubt they will seize on that point. He says, if you remember the Snoopers Charter, all of the discussions over the Communications Data Bill that happened a couple of years ago in the UK Parliament and in the media, one of the key points in that bill, which the government, it looks very much, would like to bring back in new legislation, is to say that UK ISPs should have to be monitoring UK-based communications with overseas services and generate communications data based on those. So today, that communications data I mentioned about email, if you have a UK-based email provider, that provider has UK legal obligations to store and retain some of that communications data for up to a year. What the government has been concerned about is as people switch to using instant messaging, all sorts of apps and other ways of communicating, but that if those providers are outside the UK, then communications data is not going to be generated under the UK legal framework based on those communications. So the Snoopers Charter, as it's called, the Communications Data Bill, says ISPs have to generate that themselves for UK to outside UK communications. David Anderson is not convinced by that. He said the case has not yet been made for it, but he thinks that the government should engage in an intensive dialogue, as he says, with the industry to see, well, are there other ways that we can do this without needing to get ISPs to go through that, including taking steps to encourage cooperation by overseas providers, improving what are called mutual legal assistance treaty procedures between the US in particular and the UK, so that UK police and intelligence agencies could request this data from US companies via an international law treaty route, but also in the longer term thinking about a treaty between what Anderson calls like-minded democratic nations to make it easier for digital evidence to be shared across borders. And I'll skip the last point. And then finally, so the government's response so far to these two reviews. In the Queen's speech already, the programme of legislation for this year, the government said they would bring forward an investigatory powers bill that would comprehensively cover all these different powers. So in that sense, the ISC and Anderson have persuaded the government we need pretty much a complete rewrite of the framework, not just patching a ripper. Then, on the day that the Anderson report was published earlier this week, the Home Secretary said she thinks that collectively the ISC report, the Anderson report, and the third review that is underway, that was commissioned by the Lib Dems in the last government, by the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, which will be published, I imagine, over the summer. She said, between these three reports, we think this is a good basis for discussion on what the new law should look like. Of course, what that means is the government is reserving the right to pick the bits from the three different reports that it thinks best achieve its goals. And the government then will publish a draft bill in the autumn, and that will be scrutinised by a joint committee of both Houses of Parliament. So that's a point at which, if you feel passionately about these issues and you want to get involved, that you should talk to your MP, that you should think about joining groups like the Open Rights Group, Privacy International, that are campaigning on this. That's your main chance to make a difference if you think things should be different here. And then lastly, the final point, the Prime Minister said that they would be taking forward this suggestion in the long run of this like-minded democratic community of nations coming to a treaty agreement to allow information to be more easily shared across borders. So I know there's a huge amount of information in there. Anderson's report is 400 pages. He's got 124 recommendations. I tried to pick out the main ones, and happy to talk about those later.
watched. Have you ever watched usability testing of a product or a web or website or app that you've helped make? Okay, lots of nods, that's great. And have you ever had your mind completely blown by something that the test user did or said, yes, that you could never have imagined? Thank God I'm not alone in that. I spent about half of last year having that mind-blown experience every week or twice a week working on a project around privacy, particularly a project around a privacy product for mainstream people. I work for an innovation consultancy called Adaptive Lab, which I realise makes me sound like an escape from Nathan Barley, but forgive me. And that basically means that I help other companies work out new products and services they should make and then help them make them in the right way. Last year, one of our clients came to us and said that they thought there was an opportunity for a product in the area of identity, and we did some work with them to narrow it down and then fixated on privacy, specifically online privacy, and something for ordinary people to use to help protect their privacy online. And it felt like it was kind of the right time for that. There was an awful lot of news that was touching on privacy in various different ways. Obviously, the saving regulations came out halfway through our work. And also there's the kind of tens of thousands of searches a month for Facebook privacy settings that show that there's some awareness of this already. And because we were seeing all of this in the news, we had a mistaken impression that the people who we were making that product for would probably think like us once they knew what we knew. And it's that mistaken assumption that led to so much of our surprise. And we were surprised again and again by the things that we found out that we could never have predicted. So I'm going to share a few of those in this talk. Some things I thought might be useful or interesting, and one thing that I find particularly scary that we learned about privacy. And I'll be talking very much about perceptions of privacy, so not the reality of it, but what people think about it, what their beliefs are, and the reasons behind their behaviour. And the first one, let's start with the classic, Facebook. So, we made a lot of prototypes in this project, and one of them had a sign-up flow that included Facebook login and Facebook sign-up. And we thought that made sense because we were doing some work in the product around social media privacy. But people hated it. And we assumed that they hated it because they thought we were trying to get our hands on the data that Facebook had about them, the kind of conversations they had, their preferences, things like that. But we were completely wrong. They really resented how much Facebook already knew about them. And they hated the idea of Facebook getting access to any more data, especially the kind of things that you give to a privacy product. And that hatred was so strong that even having that button on the page made people feel they just never wanted to sign up for that product. They weren't interested in it. We were tarred with the same brush, essentially. We took it off, much more comfortable. And people's attitudes to Facebook are kind of really interesting because every other bit of research we did showed that when you ask people about privacy unprompted, they talk to you about two things. They talk to you about people, and they talk to you about passwords. If you ask them about online security, they also think passwords are the be-all and end-all, so that's a little bit concerning in and of itself. But people are worried about other people. They're not really worried about companies, at least not if you don't prompt them to. And it's really people close to them. So they're not generally worried about the government. They're worried about their neighbours, their colleagues, their boss, their friends, their partner, and their teenage children. In fact, the amount of fear over teenage children was another surprise from this project. They're worried about people they know finding out things that they don't want them to know about them. And I think that's a lot to do with some mistaken beliefs about how privacy works now. I think privacy norms for a lot of people have not caught up with technology and the way that people's behaviour has changed as a result of technology changes. It's kind of connected to how people think about credit card fraud, which is something else we touched on in the same piece of work. One in 25 people a year in the UK, roughly, will be a victim of credit or debit card fraud, which is a surprisingly large number. What's even more surprising is that nobody thinks it will be them. I've talked to people who have been repeatedly victims of card fraud who confidently tell me it wouldn't happen to them. And then you remember, oh, but it did that one time. And they're not sure it won't be them because they don't think lightning will strike twice. formed on the basis that it's actually quite hard to breach their privacy. And so the only people who would want to do that are people who are very motivated, and the only people who are very motivated would be people who know them. They haven't kind of grokked how much easier it's got, and therefore how much more possible for a large group of people to get to their private information. We did some uncomfortable things to test this and get a bit more knowledge. One of which was we played a game with our research subjects where we gave them some types of information that might be available about them online or might not be, and asked them to group them into two groups. This stuff's not available, this stuff is private, this stuff is definitely available. And then we tried to find out the private stuff. And it was really genuinely quite scary how easy it was to find out things that people were completely sure were private. And in not very much time, we restricted us to 15 minutes per person to try and find everything they put in the private group. We found home addresses, lots of telephone numbers. We found the ultrasound scans for the children of one of our research participants in less than 5 minutes. I don't think people have really caught up with this new kind of world for privacy. And privacy norms they have are focused on people because they don't, people they know, because like I say, they don't know how much easier it is for anybody to get to their information. So people are worried about people, and they're worried about passwords. They really don't like Facebook most of the time. But one of the really surprising things was when he asked people about companies collecting their data and selling it on, or using it to market them, about half the people we talked to were kind of okay with it. The project team refused to believe this for several weeks, so we reran it and reran it and reran it until we finally were convinced. Some people were quite happy actually to trade off personal data in return for free services or discounts, or even sometimes just to be where their friends were, so on Facebook. So there were some people who were happy about it, they felt like they were getting a really good deal, and there were some people who were potentially less happy, but definitely okay with it. And I think for those people, it was more that they felt like that information was out there already, so they may as well get something in return for it. And so I wouldn't say everybody was happy with the trade-offs, but a surprisingly large number of people were aware that they were making trade-offs and were at peace with it. At the very least, because I think people are a bit irrational in the way that they work around this, so they can't. It would be very hard to avoid making those trade-offs. And people don't really want to put a lot of effort into stuff like that. So if they tell themselves that they're fine with it, then they don't have to put the effort in. We're all kind of lazy at the heart, so I think there's some of that irrational justification taking place. The other half of the people we spoke to, these people generally didn't know or didn't know the extent to which data was being gathered about them as they went about their online lives. They were usually extremely upset when we told them about this. They got even more upset when we told them that people might be selling that data on. And at that point, they would typically say that they would like a share of the money that Google or whoever was making. There's a neat tool where you can approximate how much you're worth to Google or Facebook. I have no idea if it's scientifically valid, but we would show them. And then they would be even more upset. I think it was, we once got somebody who was £5, and that was astonishing. Everyone else, well, £5 a year. Everybody else, much, much less. So, I suppose, one of the things that we did differently once we learned that was we were much more upfront about what we were doing, because you're never going to get everybody using anything you built. But if your product or your business relies on getting people's data and selling it or using it in some way, being upfront about that will enable the first half of people to make informed trade-offs and being honest with your users if they're mistaken in this area. And if you're not doing that, telling people you're not will reassure the second half of people. So it's something we're doing increasingly now, being upfront about this kind of thing so we can support people in making the trade-offs they want to make or not making those trade-offs. Those are the three things I think were interesting. The fourth one is the one that I feel is really kind of morally complex and probably quite scary. So this is not exactly to do with privacy, although it intersects quite a lot. It's about people's understanding of security online, so particularly the security around how their data is stored and used. We're making a privacy product. We need people to be motivated to want to use it. So we motivate them to use it, we tell them about web interface before it becomes ridiculous and stops reassuring people. We never found peak page time. So there was a point where we were replacing the blogs and password fields with tiny padlock icons. And people felt very good about that. It's basically the web design version of Security Theatre, which is a description of originally what the TSA does in American airports, which is security measures that are very apparent and kind of take a lot of bustle and fuss, but don't have a very strong relationship with actually making things secure. You're performing security instead of actually ensuring it. And padlock icons on pages, that's security bit. And it's what we'd normally refer to as a dark pattern. We are essentially training our users to look for symbols of security that are not actually representative of real security. And this is unfortunately, this is kind of fed into by education around HTTPS, because people now know that they need to look for a padlock, but they don't always remember the acronym that goes with it, or that they should be looking in the URL bar. So security data is something I've dipped into in other work since then, and I've not yet found a situation which it doesn't work. But it is a dark pattern, and if you use it, and you do all the right things to make things actually secure, you are still enabling other people to use it and then not bother with security. So, three useful things. Facebook's the enemy, you're tired of the same brush. People are worried about other people because their understanding of the technology hasn't kept up. Half the people are actually okay with you selling their data, so maybe consider telling them. And you can use security data. But like they got to say, only use it for good things. Brilliant. Thank you very much, everyone.
So